In 2004, DreamWorks, now owned by Paramount, released a movie entitled Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy. Some of you may have seen that. It's a comedy. I've never seen it, actually, because I was doing campus ministry at the time, and so my students would tell me all the things I needed to know, and now, thanks to YouTube, I can watch the funny parts of it and not have to watch the movie. But it has some funny parts, and from it, it's a story about, as you may know, Ron Burgundy, this news anchor, who is at the peak of his career. He's proud, he's arrogant in light of that. He is so stuck up because he thinks the world revolves around him. However, they are wanting to diversify because the entire news team is all male. And so they want to bring in a female newscaster. And she soon starts overshadowing Ron Burgundy. He loses his job. And thus, this story has tension and it can continue. But in order to set up and help you understand how proud, how smug this guy is, very early, actually I think it's like 10 minutes into the movie, they have a scene where he's at a dinner party, really a party around this pool and someone's, you know, house that's all decked out, and there's all this loud music going on, and he sees a woman that's very attractive and he wants to pick her up. And he gives us that what Paramount calls on their Twitter X account the pickup line that changed the game forever. And it's this. He walks up, those of you that know the scene, he walks up to this woman and he says, do you know who I am? And she says, no, I don't. And he goes, well, I don't know how to put this, but I'm kind of a big deal. You've heard me allude to that phrase before, but that's where it comes from. He actually says, yeah, just because everybody, especially all the young men, might be taking notes on their pickup line here, you know, for one, don't use that. But the line is actually, I'm kind of a big deal. People know me. I'm very important. I have many leather-bound books, and my apartment smells of rich mahogany. So, but he's kind of a big deal. And then that's why Paramount, because that's the most famous line from this movie, I believe, Paramount has pretty much said it is the pickup line that changed the game forever. Ron Burgundy's not that big of a deal. And in many ways, we look at what Mark just read, a genealogy. And I don't know about you, but you can be prone to skip it. It's not that big of a deal. And yet the author of Ruth goes, are you kidding? It's kind of a big deal. How? Why? Well, there's a lot of things we can consider, but I just want us to consider two. We're moving toward the end of our series on Godspeed. We've been doing that in community groups and looking at Ruth and how it dovetails with some of these themes that it has. Today we're still going to talk about Ruth. We don't have community groups, so we're not really doing Godspeed as much. But I want to use this to make two points about this important ending to the book. Two things where it's kind of a big deal and the author wants you to know it. So the first one is just that it's a big deal as you think about where it is. Really, the point, the wind keeps blowing my passage, so hold on. It's a big deal to the kingdom, right? David, the last word in our translation here, David, the king. Now, we saw that last week at the end of our passage we considered, because it says Obed was born and he was the grandfather of David. All right, I got to figure this wind out. Always forget that when I come here. But here we have King David. And here's the point. Where are we in the book? Very last verses. Now, think about our story so far. It's been a simple love story, right? We've talked a lot about Hesed love, this no exit strategy love of a Moabite woman showing it to her widowed mother-in-law. This Moabite woman who is a widow, and she comes, and then we get the love story of Boaz and Ruth coming. And it's just a few people, a very personal, small, simple story. Not a big deal, right? It's just three people's life. But what's the author saying? No, it's a big deal. And then you come to even how he presents it. It's a genealogy. And we go, I skipped this, like I mentioned, right? Not a big deal. And yet he's going, it's David. And remember our author, what we've seen the author of Ruth do. When he wants to surprise his readers, what does he do? He puts a detail at the very end. And so you didn't know this was coming the first time you ever read this book. Many of us are so familiar with it, we go, yeah, going with, of course. But the first time you read it, you didn't know it was coming. He's put it at the end for that reason, to surprise us, to say, this is a big deal. What seems small and simple, normal, personal, just kind of a few people, it's really insignificant and very minor. And think about, too, where it sits in your English Bible. You've got the Judges right in front of this. And I don't know about you, but I kind of go, tell me about Jephthah. Tell me about Gideon. Tell me about Samson. These are the people who ruled and fought the nations, the enemies of God. Skip this book. Then take me to Samuel, where you get the first false start with a king, but then you get Samuel and all his works and David being anointed and the kingdom rolling out, and this is powerful kingdom stuff. But what's our author saying? This little, small, insignificant story of these two widows, that's kingdom stuff too. In 1860, I'm hitting it with the dates today, I guess, but a book was published by Beadle and Adams Publishing called Maliska, the Indian Wife of the White Hunter. Does anybody know that book? It was released in the time I mentioned because the printing press had brought such technology, cheap printing could be done, and literacy was finally rising for women. So it was one of the first kind of romance novels, you might say, to be released. Guess how much they sold it for? A dime. And so you've heard the phrase before, dime store books or a dime book. That was the very first one. And they published hundreds after that because they were such a hit. And so they kept publishing all these dime store books, but kind of short, cheap. Now, compare that one. I couldn't help but read the history of that book this week. And think about when I was in seminary, my professor, I had one professor who'd gone to Oxford. And so in light of that, he liked to inflict Oxford on all of us. And my worst grades came from him and all that kind of stuff. But the last class I took with him, he made us get the biography of William Tyndale, which you guys are going to love this. It's just been released on Oxford Press. $80. $80. Versus Malika, the Indian Wife of the White Hunter, for 10 cents. My point is, we read Ruth, and it's just a small little story. Two widows who are struggling to live, and yet it's just saturated with love. And we go, it's just kind of really a dime store thing. Until the end, where the author goes, no way, this has been printed on Oxford Press, and it's worth way more than $80, because the tracks of God's kingdom ride on little acts of love, don't they? You see, I don't know about you, but this week my little acts of love felt a lot more like a dime store book than an $80 Oxford treatise. Isn't that right? And that's the good news of this book. It took generations, for one. We talked about that last week, but the little acts, going out and laying barley down for someone, are somehow participating and wrapped up in God's work of the kingdom. That I may not ever be a Gideon or a Jephthah or a Samson or a David, but you get to show up this week. What are the little acts, small, insignificant, dime store acts that God might be calling me for too? Because I so often feel that where I live. It's why Paul can write in Romans 13, how sovereign covenant king, love fulfills that law, Paul says. And that makes sense, doesn't it? Because the God of love took on flesh in a small little story with a little young virgin girl to come radically change the world through his perfect obedience and his death on the cross for sin. You start going, oh, this is how God works. And it's how he'll work this week for you. What small, easy, overlooked, humdrum, modest, simple things might God be calling you to this week? So it's a big deal for the kingdom. Next, it's a big deal for the nations. You know, in a certain sense, we know some of the younger folks in our church here better than we know some of our older folks in our church. For example, I won't pick any children out here, but those that you know, don't you go like, oh, I saw your father smile in that smile, right? Or you see their eyes and you go, you have your dad's eyes or your mother's eyes, or, oh, the inflection of your voice. It's like some of our students and student ministers, you go, oh, your voice sounds like your dad or your mom, right? You know them. And I don't know that about many of you. I never got to meet your parents. And so you go, you knew them better. Well, we've been reminded in this, the video series that goes with our sermon series, well, it doesn't go through, but that in this Godspeed, that N.T. Wright, I think, was quoted as saying, you've got to remember the small town feel of so much of the Bible. They knew your mama, and they knew your mama's mama, and they knew your mama's mama's mama, and they could say, oh, she's got this trait, this thing, this going on. And so here we have again. This is where we finally remember, and yes, I did do this since Thomas and Kristen were here. The whole town knew who Obed's mama was. And how has she been introduced to us over and over and over again? Ruth the Moab. The one who worshipped Chemosh or Chemosh. The one, the God who asked for a human to be brought to him in worship in order to be favorable on his people. This kind of violent worship, but it wasn't just Obed. They knew Boaz's mama. Who was Boaz's mama? Well, look at your worship guide. Matthew tells us. Who was she? His mom was a Canaanite. His mom was one that came from another nation. What was her situation? What did the Canaanites do? You remember the story in Judges 2 as they're coming in, and spies hide in her house, but she gives this blessing. We know God has given you this land, the true God Yahweh. Well, everyone around her, all of her upbringing, had been, no, you don't talk about Israel's God, because they say there's this believe that there are multiple gods. El is like the king of this whole pantheon of gods. That was her background. But she was brought into this God of love. When Anna Jane was first going to Covenant, we had homeschooled her all her life, and she went to Covenant. It's 10th grade. And they did their summer reading that was required, and she walks into English class. This was one of her first few days, and the teacher asks, Mrs. Baker, Lord bless her. She goes, y'all, let's talk about the themes of this book that we read. What themes do you see? And students started shouting things out, right? Mrs. Baker's writing them up on the board in big print and all that. Well, Anna Jane's new. She's pretty quiet, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And remember, Anna Jane is not dumb. She actually just graduated. She got a 4.0 undergrad and a 4.0 in grad school. She's a smart cookie. Right? And so she finally got up the courage, but it's her first time in this kind of real school, and she raises her hand and she throws out a theme. And you know what Mrs. Baker did? She goes, oh, yeah, that's interesting. We'll write that down here. She literally wrote it in the corner. That's how, in small print. Right? And yeah, and Anna Jane came home a little crushed and told us about it. And we were like, that thing, she told us about the book. And we were like, that theme is a genius. She was pulling things, right? But no, it was relegated down here to the corner. I don't know about you, but I tend to read the Old Testament and think Israel, David, kingdom, judges, that's all up here. Nations? I know I heard something about a promise to Abraham, but they're kind of relegated down here to the corner. We don't see much of them. Are you kidding, the author would say? Here at the turning point of taking the land where we started messing up with Judges and we're about to enter into the kingdom with David, what is the turning point? Two people from outside God's people Israel. God is committed to the nations. And that should give us hope, right? I mean, the fact that, what is God doing? It is Genesis 12, where God says to Abram, I will bless you, giving you heritage and a family. Well, that's what he's going to do through David, right? Building a kingdom. And then he says, all of the nations will be blessed. Well, he says, I'm going to do that first, and you're going to see it in Rahab the prostitute, and you're going to see it in Ruth. God is doing this work. And the author is saying, don't miss it. That's why he gives us these things at the end. And so, hope. We get to participate. Move forward in that hope, for one, that God is reaching neighbor and nations. God is reaching the nations that have come to us in our neighborhood, and he is building his church around the world. And so we get to participate in our classic ways of praying, giving, going, and connecting. I also end in this way. Here's what happened yesterday. I saw two different sports on TV. When I was going to bed last night, the Stanley Cup playoffs were on, and I had them on while I was brushing my teeth and I'm watching. But you know, I don't really care about hockey. I have to be honest. I've never played it. I just kind of go, you know, so I turned it off. On the other hand, I've played tennis. I'm not great at it, but I grew up, my parents played it, and we played it some. And so the French Open, whatever they're calling it now, they're giving it some different name, but that was on, and there was an incredible game that I needed to go out and mow the lawn, but instead I sat and watched it. Why was I more into tennis than I was to hockey? Because I've participated in it before. I've done it. I in no way could do the drop shots and things like that, but that's where I would want to go out and try that because I've seen those drop shots. What's my point? The way we as a church talk about we're missionaries too, does that make it more like hockey or more like tennis? You see, what happens is as we begin to understand as a church that we're missionaries as well, reaching nations, reaching outsiders, I all of a sudden listen to Thomas and Kristen and I go, hey, what are they doing there? Because I see their drop shot they're given over there. Maybe we should consider that drop shot here. And so there's this argument that people say, oh, if the American church thinks too much like we're the mission, or we're on mission together with folks, that we'll neglect over there. I go, no way. We'll be more involved. We'll cheer for them more. We'll pray for them more. We'll give for them more because they're like us. They're playing tennis too. But who's the great tennis player? It's God. Because we see here God. Saying.